Hey, everybody, welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Paulson. I'm the executive director of LRIS, and I'm your monthly host here at the First Thursday podcast. This month, we're going to walk through recent developments in public safety labor law, union representation, and agency practice. And it's a bit of a grab bag this month. It's interesting. We've got a pretty sweeping state Supreme Court decision out of Ohio regarding police privacy. We've got a landmark state appellate court decision out of my home state of Pennsylvania in a case our firm is involved in, involving firefighters and post-traumatic stress. And those two big cases, the Ohio case and the PA case, both deal with this issue of, police officers and firefighters and correctional officers are real people just like everybody else. And sometimes the rules out there in the law don't reflect that. The Ohio case and the Pennsylvania case, I think, actually are examples where courts get it right. We also are going to go around the country. I got a pretty neat case out of California, the after effects of a no confidence vote. And then we have a couple of cases involving probationary employees. It's kind of two sides of the probationary employee coin. So lots of different things. We might even do a past practice case if I have time. I don't know. I'm not sure. But welcome to First Thursday for December of 2025. Let's see if we can get through all that stuff. First up, I suppose I have to give you guys an update on what's happening with LRIS and our seminars. We've got three great seminars coming up in 2026, two in Nashville, one in Las Vegas. We can't stay away from Vegas too long. We just had three in Vegas. We were in Vegas in September, October, and November. I must confess, I'm a little Vegas out, but I will get fired up again by the time I have to get back there in the spring. Our first seminar, though, is in Nashville. January 20th to 30th is our Public Safety Union Leadership Seminar. That one's great. Normally, we have lawyers teach at these seminars. You know, they aren't legal seminars, but the union leadership one, we have union leaders, you know, from public safety unions all across the country, big and small, talking about what it takes to run a union, finances, bylaws, internal structures. The theme this year is communication. What are effective communication tools to communicate with members, to communicate with the broader community, to make sure that our messaging is okay? And we also spend a little bit of time on wellness and member safety and PTS issues as well. So we're really going to cover a lot of ground. If you have any interest in checking that one out, we'd love to come and see you. We'd love it if you could come and see us at Nashville in January. We're going to be back in Nashville the middle of April for our collective bargaining seminar. That's probably our most popular seminar. We're going to have a labor negotiator, a management negotiator. I'll be there. We're going to have an economist. We're going to just talk about everything, every aspect of negotiations, from prep through what happens at the table, through ratification, through like interest arbitration and mediation proceedings, and all of the kind of best practices that labor and management use in these things. And, I've got a union tilt, right? But we do try to call it like we see it and keep it pretty even-handed at these things. And then back in the summertime, we will be back in Vegas when it's nice and hot, from June 17th to 19th, for our Rights of Police Officers seminar. Again, a biggie. We're going to send out the announcement for that one, I think, like this week or next week. And privacy is going to be a biggie. One of the cases we talk about, we're probably going to be talking about in June. Privacy, speech rights, what's going on with artificial intelligence, all of these things that are affecting law enforcement agencies from a labor relations perspective, we spent 2.5 days on. So three fun seminars. If you want any information about any of that stuff, check that out at lrs.com/seminars. Okay, well, let's go on to the cases. And like I noted, there are a couple of two big cases that I want to talk about that are fairly recent. And for those of you guys who get the newsletter, the Public Safety Labor News, if you don't, by the way, become a premium subscriber and get the newsletter. It's awesome. It's a great resource. There's like 10 to 15 cases every month. A lot of the cases that we talk about here come from the newsletter, and including a couple that we'll talk about this month. Some of them are like so new, though, that we didn't have time to do it. So the two big cases I want to talk about won't be in the December newsletter, they'll probably be in the January newsletter, and including this first one. And the first one is Gatehouse Media versus Columbus Police Department. It was decided by Ohio Supreme Court on November 25th, 2025. So just a couple of days before Thanksgiving. By the way, I hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving, a safe Thanksgiving. So what happened in this case? This is a really interesting privacy case involving a case out of the city of Columbus. And when I say Gatehouse Media versus the Columbus Police Department, that's the Columbus Dispatch. It's like the paper of record in Columbus. I'm actually recording this, by the way, on the day of the Ohio State Michigan football game. So lots of Columbus running through my head today, which is, I think, a good thing, and probably bodes well for the Buckeyes. So the Gatehouse Media case involves Ohio's version of Marcy's Law. And Marcy's Law, is a kind of a term of art for statutes that stand for the statutes or constitutional amendments in a lot of states that stand for protecting certain rights of victims. And whether that is rights to be informed of the progress of prosecution for a case in which they're a victim, or rights to be involved in the sentencing procedures, rights to be notified if an offender involved in their case is released, and rights related to privacy and privacy protections that they have. And each state will have, or states that have Marcy's Law, either statutes or constitutional provisions, we're going to have some variation of that. The first Marcy's Law was out in California. Ohio has one. And this is a really neat case because, like I said at the outset of the podcast, it deals with this question of sometimes we forget that because of the work that they do, the police officers are just like people, just like anybody else. And that means that they can, in fact, be victims of crimes, and therefore would have protections under Marcy's Law, or Ohio's version of Marcy's Law. And that's exactly what came up in this particular case. And it was decided by the Supreme Court, again, at the end of November. It has to do with the rights of officers under Ohio's 2017 constitutional amendment expanding crime victim rights and privacy protections. And so the case began when the Columbus Dispatch asked for information from the city of Columbus and its police department. And specifically, the dispatch requested the names of eight police officers who responded to a July 2023 bank robbery. And I think that was in Hilliard, Ohio. I'm not sure where that is. I don't know that I have to know where that is. After a pursuit, officers exchanged gunfire with a suspect on Interstate 70. One officer was shot and seriously injured, and the suspect in the matter was shot and killed. In the wake of that incident, which received a lot of attention in the press, as you might imagine, the newspaper requested the names of basically all the officers that were on scene there. The city of Columbus refused to release the information, citing Marcy's Law and saying basically, well, these officers were responding to a crime, but in the course of that response, they were attacked by the one of the persons who had perpetrated this bank robbery, right? And shot and killed an officer, attempted to harm other officers. So these officers were victims, right, of a crime. The city says, we're not going to give up the information because these guys are protected under Marcy's Law. We're prohibited from releasing that information. And the newspaper sued them. And the gist of the argument was that, Marcy's Law was never intended to conceal the identities of on-duty public employees, right? So if you're on duty, you're a public employee, you're a police officer acting in your official capacity, you're not supposed to be protected by this particular law that protects victims. Essentially, what the newspaper was saying then is police officers cannot be victims. Think about that, right? And so a bit of a double standard there. Now, what about Ohio's version of Marcy's Law? It was added to the state constitution. That's been done in a lot of states. Ohio, I think that was done in 2017. There was implementing legislation enacted the following year. Like many other Marcy's Law amendments, Ohio's version guarantees crime victims the right to be treated with quote unquote fairness and respect for their safety, dignity, and privacy, right, throughout the criminal process. And it specifically prevents disclosure of information that could be used to locate or harass victims of crime. Again, your identity, I think, might be part of that. And it defines victim, right? So, we can argue over what a victim is, who a victim is, who a victim isn't, but the law itself, the statute itself, defines victim, and it does so as, quote, any person against whom a criminal offense is committed or who is directly harmed by a criminal offense. Pretty broad definition. Last time I checked, police officers were persons, right? Yeah, they really are. And you think this might be a no-brainer, but there's pretty controversial legal action here. And so the court ultimately issued a decision at the end of November, and the court agreed with me and agreed with the Ohio FOP that did an outstanding job in litigating this case. By the way, shout out to Gwen Callender and her team. They're fantastic. And the court said this is not close, right? The plain language, according to the Court of Marcy's Law, I just read you the definition of victim, applies to police officers who are shot at or harmed by criminal suspects. Now I'm going to quote from the decision here. Quote, applying the text of the amendment, we, the court, have no difficulty concluding that an ordinary understanding of Marcy's Law's definition of victim encompasses the officers in this case, because the officers were fired upon during the pursuit. The court said they easily fall within Marcy's Law's scope. And the court went a little bit further. I mean, that's pretty clear, right? End of story. The court also knocked down some of the other arguments that the newspaper raised. The newspaper argued that Ohio's Constitution guaranteed a general right to obtain public records that overrides constitutional privacy protections, right? So this is the old my rights versus yours, right? I mean, that's what the law is all about, especially constitutional law. Whose rights are going to govern here? And so what the newspaper argued basically was that, the citizens and the newspapers saying it's acting on behalf of citizens or as its own in its own right as a corporate citizen has some protections, has some interest in transparency regarding government relations. And that right that citizens have trumps individual privacy rights in this particular case of officers. And the court rejected that. Again, I want to quote from the decision. Even if we were to conclude that the Constitution provides some generalized right to obtain public records, we would be hard-pressed to say that this generalized right prevails over the more specific guarantee of crime victim privacy rights established by Marcy's Law. Some good old statutory interpretation by the Supreme Court, or constitutional interpretation by the Supreme Court, where something specific is going to trump something general. And you were normally going to see that come down that way. And so the court said, yeah, there are these general notions of transparency, recognizing the citizen's interest in matters related to government. But where we have more specific protections of equal rights in the Constitution, privacy rights here, that's going to govern. And that's what the court determined. The court in this case then basically held that the city could lawfully and did lawfully redact the officers' names and any identifying information about the officers in the release of information that they provided to the dispatch. The decision makes very clear that when a police officer in Ohio is injured, if they're threatened, if they're otherwise harmed by any type of criminal act, that that officer's identity can be withheld under Ohio's public records law. That's a really strong decision. It's a decision that had a lot of eyes on it. I know we've been talking about this for a little while. There's a bad decision out of Florida, different statute, different language, not as strong, quite frankly, as Ohio's language, that went the other way and did provided lesser protections or and very few protections to police officers out of Florida Supreme Court in a 2023 decision. This one, in my view, went the right way. There's going to be more to come following this. Folks are going to want to go back to the legislature and see if they can carve out an exception for law enforcement officers or for other individuals. I think that proponents or the dispatch and other groups are intending to do that. We shall see what happens in the state legislature. In coverage of the decision, I was struck by a quote by Brian Steele. He's the president of the FOP Lodge in Columbus. And I love this quote. And he says, you don't all of a sudden stop being a victim because of the uniform you wear, right? And if we have legal protections that are intended to protect victims of crime, and a police officer so happens to be a victim of a crime, then of course they should be protected, under those statutes. In other words, you're not a second-class citizen, right? You do have the same rights as other citizens, unless there's a specific carve-out in the law, that indicates clearly that you are entitled to lesser protections. That didn't exist here, and that's why the Supreme Court decided the way they did. I think a really good decision out of Ohio. Certainly in the wake of a bad decision out of Florida, we will see as legal challenges come down in the future, whether courts will choose to go the Ohio way or the Florida way. And of course, we will keep you posted on all this stuff at LRS because that's what we do. Our next case, which I think falls into this same category, of first responders or people too, comes out of Pennsylvania, and it was decided by Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court on October 23rd. And this is a lot of folks are calling this one another landmark decision involving the rights of first responders, police officers, firefighters, correctional officers, as it relates to post-traumatic stress. And the case is Ganley v. Upper Darby Township. It was decided by Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court on October 23rd, 2025. And again, caveat, it's my firm. One of my partners, Mike Dryden, tried this case. I don't really love talking about cases that we happen to be involved in, but hey, we're involved in cases sometimes that become big cases. And so I'm going to talk about it. What happened in Ganley versus Upper Darby? Upper Darby Township, by the way, it's a suburb of Philadelphia. It's connected to Philadelphia on the southwest side of Philadelphia. It's in Delaware County. So if you watched Task, right? Yeah, it's Delco. It's that Delco. And so it's a great place. It's about 100,000 people. It's a pretty big suburb. If you didn't know you were in a suburb, you would just think you were in a neighborhood in Philadelphia. Lots of row houses, very densely populated area, high workload, heavy workload, lots of risks faced by Upper Darby's firefighters, including Brian Ganley. Brian had been on the job for, I think, over 20 years of service with the fire department. Great work record. No discipline, decorated, that type of thing. And he had two really problematic responses that were 2.5 years apart. They weren't days apart. They weren't just a few months apart. They were 2.5 years apart, but they were a big deal. And two incidents. One was in November of 18 and one in May of 21. Brian wound up responding to the scenes of infant medical emergencies. He had to perform CPR on infants and in both instances, and in both instances, the babies died. Terrible outcomes. You all know the people who are listening to this podcast, have been in, these situations and horrible situations where you see and you experience things that normal people don't, right? That's why there's a thing called PTS, right? It's a normal response to an extraordinary circumstance. That's my dumbed down definition of PTS, but that's why so many first responders suffer from post-traumatic stress injuries. The problem that we see is that the law in different states, workers' compensation laws are going to be different, but the law, generally speaking, right, hasn't caught up to the science as it relates to traumatic stress injuries and police officers and firefighters. In Brian Ganley's situation, he has those two responses. There's two terrible situations where babies died in his arms after he gave CPR. He started to feel the effects pretty seriously. And he was later diagnosed with PTS as part, actually, a fire department doctor diagnosed Ganley with PTS. And he wound up submitting a claim for workers' compensation. As the case made its way through the court, it was determined that firefighter Ganley was permanently disabled, that he would never be able to return to work as a firefighter. There was no physical injury associated with this. It was just the mental injury, right? The post-traumatic stress injury that he sustained during the course of his job. Ganley, filed for workers' compensation benefits, and his employer denied his claim. And the reason why they denied the claim was because of a strange legal standard that existed in Pennsylvania law, not in Pennsylvania's workers' compensation statute. It just came out of case law, came out of a court decision decided decades ago that basically said if you suffer a mental injury in connection with a physical injury. So if you are a firefighter, you fall through a floor, you break your leg, and you've got the physical injury, and you also suffer from traumatic stress as a result of that, you're going to be okay. It's going to be relatively easy to make that claim for benefits if for some reason your employer refuses to provide you with benefits. But if you have a mental injury that's not associated with a physical injury, right? So if you don't fall through the floor and break your leg, but you just, you experience what firefighter Ganley did, and you suffered a very real, these are, you guys know this, these are real injuries. It's as real as getting hit in the knee with a hammer, man. These PTS injuries are real, and it's taken a long time to try to educate agencies and educate employees about that so that people get the help they need. And it turns out, it's not a lot. Doesn't take much to get somebody back on track, but we have to make sure that we're identifying folks and helping them. The standard under Pennsylvania law made it really difficult. It made it less likely for people to ask for help because if you sustained only a mental injury, if you only had a post-traumatic stress injury, it was more difficult to make your claim. And so what you had to prove in connection with your claim was that the injury was sustained as a result of abnormal working conditions, for your job. So it's not just something you normally would deal with in the course of your job. It had to be something extraordinarily unusual for your job in order to make a claim for post-traumatic stress. And that was the standard for everybody, for all employees, people who work in offices, people who work at the Kmart, people, whatever the heck it is. A mental injury would have to flow solely from an abnormal working condition. But what happens if you're a firefighter or a police officer and you deal with abnormal stuff all the time, right? That's your job. So what may be abnormal for me in my office might be very normal, right, for you at work. But hey, an injury is an injury. It hurts just the same. It affects you just the same. And so you had this really difficult standard where people would file claims for benefits and be rejected because they couldn't prove, right, that the experience that they had at work wasn't abnormal for a police officer, because police officers find themselves in terrible situations every day. And so what happens is over time, people don't ask for help because they know the claim's going to be denied. They tough it out, things get worse. And I don't have to tell anybody listening to this podcast about rates of suicide and substance abuse in the public safety professions. It's a big, big problem. And I'm glad that finally, right, finally, it seems like collectively, at all of the state levels, we're taking steps to address traumatic stress, whether it's through improving state statutes and whether there's presumptive statutes for PTS for public safety personnel, or just developments in workers' compensation laws, better training, better tools out there. I would say that the industry is doing a really good job, but it's not as quickly as we need it to be. Pennsylvania was really behind the curve in terms of its case law in applying this abnormal working condition standard. And the reason why the Commonwealth Court decision is so important, and the reason we're talking about it, is this is the first decision in Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court granted a workers' compensation claim for a firefighter who sustained just a post-traumatic stress injury, not connected to any other physical injury. And why did it do that? The court determined that in this case, the horrific circumstances that Ganley experienced, right, the deaths of two infants he personally tried to save, were indeed abnormal working conditions for a firefighter. So the court didn't change the standard, but what we're seeing is the court recognizing that the standard that it set, it might have made some sense 40 years ago, but it doesn't really make sense today, knowing what we now know, right? And that's that there is a much higher rate of PTS injuries and much higher rate of exposure for police officers, firefighters, correctional officers with these types of for these types of injuries than there are for the regular, civilian worker elsewhere in the workforce. And we saw that there was a decision, a concurring opinion in this case, and that's a case where, we have a majority opinion of the court. And if it's a panel, and this is an appellate panel, so you might have one judge who authors the decision and a couple of other judges who sign on, say, yep, we agree with the outcome, we agree with the rationale. And that's a typical majority opinion. And a dissenting opinion, I think folks know, a dissenting opinion is if a judge disagrees with the outcome and the judge says, well, I would have gone the other way, and here's why. Concurring opinions don't get as much attention. And that's where a judge joins the majority. votes in with the majority, but might have something else to say, might have reached the outcome in a different way, or might want to raise a point that in that particular judge's opinion wasn't emphasized as much by their colleagues in the majority. And that's what happened in the Ganley case. There's a concurring opinion in which a concurring judge, urged that the abnormal working condition standard just be completely scrapped altogether, that the Commonwealth Court or that the state Supreme Court should revisit this concept. They called it an outdated legal concept that forces courts to make quote unquote elusive distinctions about what is normal and what's abnormal in high risk professions. Right? It ignores essentially the reality of a modern psychological understanding of the risks faced by first responders. And so, that's very interesting to have a concurring decision that advocates that. That is how the law changes, the common law changes over the years. An opinion like that that might be relied on in a future instance. We'll see where the case goes. It's important we're talking about it because it's yet another court that has recognized what the science is telling us, and that's that there is a very high incidence of post-traumatic stress among public safety personnel. And so, it's a great decision for firefighter Ganley. And for Upper Darby firefighters. And also, as a postscript, I'll note that the law actually, right around the same time that the court decision was issued, Pennsylvania law changed, statutory law changed. A law that was passed in 2024 became effective this fall. And that actually acknowledged a presumption. It recognized a presumption for post-traumatic stress. For police officers, firefighters, and correctional officers, and specifically did away with the abnormal working conditions standard, but only did it for a few years, right? For a few years, you get that benefit. After that, you have to litigate it the old-fashioned way, and that's where this decision regarding abnormal working conditions, I think, is probably going to prove to be pretty helpful. So a really good decision. And so again, we have a why are we talking about it? We have got a decision from Ohio. In the Marcy's Law case, we have a decision from Pennsylvania in this PTS case where you have people, on the across the table from police officers or firefighters saying you should be treated differently, right? Because of the work that you do. And whether it's that you shouldn't have the same protections in one case in Ohio, saying you're not a victim in the same way that anybody else is a victim if you get shot at. And in Pennsylvania, right, you have people saying, well, if you're injured because of something crazy that happens at work, but you work in a field where there's a lot of risk, oh well, tough whatever, you should have taken a different job. So they're both pretty similar in that we have these unreasonable positions taken by, I guess we say opponents in these cases, and we have two really good decisions, two really well-reasoned decisions. That provide, I think, a modernized take on the rights of these public safety employees. So great job, Ohio FOP, and great job, Upper Darby firefighters. Hope to see more positive cases like that, and they could go management's way, but positive cases that reflect the law changing over time to reflect the reality that we're seeing out there. So good decisions. Next case is related to the case after that. So we had a pair of cases, where I think we had the right outcome for police and fire, it recognizing changes in the law, and just an updating of the law to meet the times. And now we have another pair of companion cases, one out of Michigan and another out of another Pennsylvania case, actually, that deal with probationary employees. And one is like the old school way of dealing with probationary employees, and the other is, I guess, a new school way. Or a pretty interesting way of treating probationary employees. And, the treatment of probationary employees is something we get a lot of questions on. Just in my practice, I get questions about this stuff. But at seminars, we have a discipline seminar we do every year. And, we do get quite, and we have grievance and arbitration seminar that I think we're doing this fall or fall 26. Check it out at LRS.com. Where people say, well, what about, probationary employees? If you're a probationer, can you file a grievance? Like, what rights do you have? And the answer to that, my answer, well, it's usually, well, it depends, because I'm a lawyer and I'm bound to say that. I have to say that or else I'll lose my license. Usually it depends on what's in the contract, and can you bargain over those rights? Can you set forth what somebody is entitled to and what they're not entitled to? The answer is yeah, it's going to be yeah, unless there's some type of statutory prohibition. Normally, what are we talking about when we're saying somebody is probationary? What we really mean is that they're going to be at will. So if you have a 12-month probation period, it doesn't mean that none of the contract applies to an employee, right? Their wage rates are set, their vacation, their leave, and all the other rights of the contract will generally apply to an employee, with one exception. If you have a contract with a just cause standard, or if you're in a place that has a bill of rights that sets a cause standard, that probationary employees generally won't be protected by those standards for the length of the probationary period, right? So they're going to be essentially what we would call at will, which means the employer can fire them for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason, just so long as it's not an illegal reason. By the way, most of the country works under that standard, right? At will employment. That's the way it works in most places, not in the public sector, all right? But in the private sector, for sure, that's how it works. But that's generally, how it works with probationary employees. And sometimes unions are like, well, what are we really supposed to do when a probationary employee is called in for discipline? Do we have to do anything? And I usually say, yeah, sure you do. You provide the same protections that anybody else would be entitled to. But the caveat is if the employer decides they're going to discipline the person, well, that's it. You can't grieve it. You can't go anywhere else. They're going to have final say again, unless there's some type of illegal or improper motivation that could trigger an individual right that the employee might have. But generally, employers can do what they want with probationary employees. The bigger problem that I see with probationary employees is when the employer, I'll call it the shit or get off the pot rule. You have a 12-month probationary period and the employer doesn't know what to do. And they come to the union and they say, hey, so we're not sure we want to let go of so and so. Would you agree to extend the probation period? And then they put the union in a box, right? And most union, my advice to unions mostly is no. Say no. You're a manager, you got to manage. I'm a big fan of actively managed probationary periods, and the employer should be weeding out the weak links, and unions should want that too, right? Because once they get past their probationary period, they're your problem, right? So, but usually that's where it becomes an issue for the union. So what happened in the first case out of Michigan? This is out of Wayne County. It's a jail case. It's a juvenile detention facility. And we had an officer who was hired by the juvenile facility in June of 2024. She's a probationary officer, and she was terminated basically 3 weeks after she started. She didn't make it too far into her. This wasn't like 11 months and 3 weeks, right? She was like 2 or 3 weeks on the job, following what the decision called a quote unquote significant security incident at the facility. And basically, there were like a handful of residents who were out of their cells. They're not, it's a juvenile facility. I can't say cell, but you know what I'm talking about. This is a cell, it's a jail. They were out of their rooms, let's say, rooms with locked doors without authorization. And then there was a big fight, right? So, the officer on duty basically wasn't doing their job, right? Is the allegation, or things got out of hand. What they called the officer in, they read her the riot act and they wrote her up. And they gave her the write-up and they gave it to her to sign and confirm that she received it. And she pushed back. She said she wasn't going to sign the document. The document wasn't accurate. She wanted to give her side of the story. Apparently, maybe she was argumentative, maybe she wasn't, but they fired her. She immediately goes to file a grievance. She says, I was wrongly terminated. I didn't do this stuff you're telling me about. And she filed an unfair labor practice. She actually filed two unfair labor practice charges, once again, one against the jail and one against the union, because she said, the jail shouldn't have fired me. There's no reason for them to fire me, melee notwithstanding. And the union didn't do anything about it. The union violated its duty of fair representation by failing to file a grievance challenging my termination through the grievance procedure. That's a pretty typical and a pretty straightforward probationary employee situation. And there's an ALJ for the Michigan Labor Board. It's actually a commission. The Michigan Employee Relations Commission is what Employment Relations Commission is what that's called. Pretty easy case for Merck. They dismissed the charges. They said, look, you're probationary. There weren't any facts established alleging that somehow you were engaging in protected activity or union activity. Or that your termination was somehow motivated by any of that stuff. They concluded no. I mean, this was just a response to what the employer believes you did at work. And because of that, there were no violations of the act. As it relates to the union, it was even easier. The court, the ALJ noted that there was no ability under the contract to grieve discipline. Termination was specifically excluded from the formal grievance procedure in the contract, and because of that, despite that, the union did still try to help her out through the process and even actually advocated a little bit for the employer to give her another chance, but would not go to the point of filing a grievance. And the board said, yeah, that wasn't arbitrary, it wasn't discriminatory, they weren't acting in bad faith. And so none of those things were even close to causing the union to be in violation of its duty to fairly represent this particular member. So what happened? Charge dismissed. The correctional officer, I'm sure, has found another job. Pretty tough to lose your job as a CO, right? So she probably found another one real quick these days. But that's pretty, common, normal, typical probationary employee case. All right, so keep that in the back of your mind. And now let's go not too far to Pennsylvania. And this is a case involving Pennsylvania State Police. It's a Pennsylvania State Labor Board decision. If you want the case site, you can see it, on our website. It's 57 PPER 17. It was decided by the Pennsylvania Labor Relations Board a little earlier this year. Now, this one concerns the state police terminating a new trooper in May of 2024. And at the time of his discharge, the trooper had not yet completed the probationary period. They have an 18-month probationary period. The trooper is, X number of months into it, but he hadn't completed his 18. The state police fire him. That's it. We're done, right? Probationary, end of story. Why are we even talking about it? Well, we're talking about it because the union, the Pennsylvania State Troopers Association, filed a grievance challenging the termination anyway. Oh, that's interesting. And basically, they said that notwithstanding his probationary status, right? The trooper, the new trooper, was a member of the bargaining unit from day one, and therefore was entitled to all of the procedural rights that were set forth in the CBA before the discipline action was finalized. The association didn't challenge the merits of the termination, didn't get into that, didn't seek reinstatement even. It just wanted a straightforward recognition of the procedural rights in the contract. And so, the contract between the Troopers Association and the state had essentially like kind of police officer Bill of Rights provisions baked in there regarding notice and a process, right? Certain procedural rights related to discipline that in this particular instance, because it was, and they made no bones about it. They said, because this guy's probationary, we don't need to do any of that. If you just call him in and say, you're fired, good luck and God bless. And the union said, no, that's not right, right? There's a lot of pre-discipline protections that are in the contract. And so the union files their grievance. They said you were supposed to do an administrative interview, right? Call you in, for a Weingarten interview, right? Is normally what we call that. There was no notification of the inquiry, no union representation, because in that group they have to notify the union and provide a union rep there. There wasn't a pre-discipline conference. There was nothing, none of the normal things that would exist, for a trooper who's beyond their probation, were provided to this particular officer. And the union asserted that, that was a breach of the contract, and this probationary officer was entitled to more. The Commonwealth, and Pennsylvania is very special, so it's not a state. Don't call it a state. You'll make people angry. It's a Commonwealth. So the Commonwealth, what's the difference between a Commonwealth and a state, by the way? Nothing, right? Nothing. The Commonwealth denies the grievance, goes to arbitration. At arbitration, the parties agree to bifurcate, the question to see, well, whether is this grievance even arbitrable? If somebody's probationary, can the union even grieve these types of things? So the arbitrator was going to answer that question first. And if he got past that, then kind of get to the merits of the dispute. What happened though was the union, for again, whatever reason, and I don't represent this union, I don't know the context, but the union subpoenaed the chief, essentially the colonel, the guy who runs the state police, to attend the arbitration hearing. They sent a lot of subpoenas for several information. My guess is that they were just angry, probably a lot of other things too, but for somebody just completely ignoring somebody's rights under the contract. So they subpoenaed the boss. They asked for a lot of information. It becomes a big fight, over the information requested or whether or not you could compel the colonel to come and testify at these things. And so basically what happened is on the eve of the arbitration, the Commonwealth told the Union, you know what? We're not going. Tough. Have it without us, but we're not going to be there. And the hearing was canceled. What did the Union do? They filed an unfair practice charge. And so that's how this case makes its way to the State Labor Board. The union filed a ULP charge, and it gets assigned to a hearing examiner. It's essentially the same as an administrative law judge, which might be what they call them in your state, wherever you are. And at the hearing, the Commonwealth argued that there is a case. There's an old case out of a suburban police department that that said, look, probationary police officers are at-will employees, and they have no rights, to appeal a dismissal. The union said, yeah, we get it, but that's not what we were talking about. In fact, we didn't even challenge the merits of the dismissal and the grievance. We have a whole separate, section of the contract that we believe that you violated. That's what went before the hearing examiner. And the hearing examiner for the labor board agreed with the union. The contract says, it says that there's a probationary period section of the CBA, says that you can be fired during the 18-month or at the conclusion of the 18-month probationary period without regard to the grievance procedure, right? So you don't get to file a grievance. That's pretty clear. But there are other sections of the contract, right? That, especially the rights section that says that all troopers have specific pre-discipline rights, union representation, the meeting, all of those types of things. And there was no carve-out, in that provision that says probationary people don't get this. Now, whether that was the intent or not, I haven't the foggiest idea, but that's not what the contract says, right? And an arbitrator or a hearing examiner is going to be left with the words on the page ordinarily. We have a case about that we'll talk about ordinarily. And we have a provision that provides rights and does not say that probationary employees don't get that. Here's a quote from the decision. The hearing examiner says, quote, the parties in the instant matter have indeed negotiated an express provision in the CBA covering probationary employees and their access to the grievance procedure. By refusing to arbitrate, right, the Commonwealth unilaterally interpreted the bargain for agreement to basically say that no other aspects of the agreement applied to probationary employees. So they expanded this one real limited exception to say that the rest of the contract didn't apply. The hearing examiner said, no, there's no way. What did the hearing examiner do? Ordered the Commonwealth to cease and desist from refusing to bargain. And that was essentially by refusing to appear at the arbitration hearing. Ordered the Commonwealth to go back, process the grievance to arbitration. If anyone knows how that one turned out, let me know. My guess is it went back to arbitration. My prediction is there was an award by the arbitrator issued that said that the Commonwealth violated the procedural rights of the contract, and that's it. There's no remedy, there's no nothing. In fact, because of that, probably there was a settlement agreement. If you know what happened, shoot us an email at info@LRAS, and I'll keep you posted. Okay. Another case, I got two more cases I want to talk about. I'll talk about them kind of quick. I have to have one where the employer wins, right? You can't just have the union win all these things. You guys are going to think I'm more biased than I already am. But we're going to do one where the union wins. So let's go to California. This is Compton Firefighters. It's IFF 2216 versus City of Compton. It's a PERB decision out of California, decided in August of this year. I like this one because it's a no confidence vote case. I am not a big fan of the no confidence vote. People ask me all the time, should we do a no confidence vote? And like, I don't know, man. Like, it might feel good, but ask yourself, what are you really going to accomplish? And in fact, are you going to, cause the employer to double down and really embrace the chief or whoever that you no confidence? Lots of things in there. We talk about that at our bargaining seminar. That's where we get a lot of discussion about that and how that plays a role in bargaining. So if you want to come out and see us in Nashville in April, that might be fun. Come on out and do it. All right. So basically, what happened in this particular case? Compton Fire Department, like lots of fire departments, because of the schedule and the length of the shift, firefight and the nature of the work, the physical nature of the work, firefighters in the city were permitted to work out at the station. They had like a regular morning fitness workout. They had people probably certified to run those things, right? It's a big part of that particular workforce. The IFF is great. on wellness and fitness issues. The IFC, the fire chiefs, are great about that too. And so we had this long-standing practice of letting people work out. There were mandatory fitness levels that the department had, and so this is, hey, we're going to have levels that we're going to hold you to, but we're going to give you opportunity. Yes, it's during work time, right? But we're going to give you an opportunity to work out at work so that you can reach those standards. That was how it worked, right? You get to the end of 2023 and things aren't going well. There's just a bad relationship. I don't know the backstory. If you guys want to email me, tell me the backstory. I'm happy to hear about it and I'll pass it on. But there were lots of unfair practice charges. There were lots of grievances. There were changes to staffing policies and equipment policies and lots of things like that. And the union holds in 2023, not one, but two no confidence votes against their chief. And the first one is the worst. This is the worst, right? They hold a no confidence vote and it's a tie, right? So listen, pro tip. If you get a no confidence, your chief, you better win, right? If you don't have the no confidence vote wired, holy crap, don't do that. So they no confidence the chief, or they try to no confidence the chief, and it doesn't go well. It splits, so that one fails. But then a little later in 2023, they do it again. And in fact, the majority votes to no confidence the chief. The union sends a letter to the city saying, we've no confidence the chief. We want you to get rid of the chief. They didn't say that specifically. I think they said, we want you to evaluate the current leadership of the fire department. But you and I know what the union meant. And the union meant the chief's got to go, right? He doesn't have the support of the troops. He's got to split. That was on November 7th. That's an important date in this charge. So November 7th, they do the vote. The next day, they send a letter. And on November 16th, right, a couple of days after that vote, the chief sends an email to everybody, right? It's in italics, so it's important. At least it wasn't in caps. Anyway, so here's the email. It says, effective immediately, there will be no physical fitness workouts during business hours. Everybody has to be, now I'm not quoting anymore, but everybody has to be in uniform the entirety of your shift, right? I'm sure that was just coincidental. And the same day, he goes and he inspects all fire stations. Hadn't done it since 2017. Had never done it, right? But he's 6 years in, he gets no confidence. A couple of days later, he says, nobody can work out anymore, and I'm going to inspect fire stations. I mean, revenge is best served cold, isn't it? Right? So you got to wait a little bit, dude. He doesn't do that. Union files an unfair practice charge. Not hard, right? They file it. They say that the one, we have a unilateral change in our fitness for our fitness policy, whether it was done a week after a no confidence vote or not. You can't do that. That's a unilateral change to working conditions. You didn't bargain with us over that. But not only that, this was retaliatory. The chief did this certainly in response to our engaging in protected and concerted activity by expressing our lack of confidence in the fire chief. They took that to an administrative law judge. For California's Labor Relations Board, and that is exactly what an ALJ found. He agreed with the union. He found that the timing was problematic, and that certainly the chief was aware of what was going on of these things, and that the workout ban and the simultaneous inspections were motivated by what we call anti-union animus, right? He's mad at the union. He did these things because he didn't like what the union had done. And it also was just a unilateral change to a mandatory subject of bargaining. The city appealed that to the state labor board, and the state labor board agreed, determining that the chief's actions were both retaliatory and a unilateral change in violation of the act. And so, what did the board do? It's what the board can do: ordered the city to rescind the directive, right? Go back to the old policy permitting workouts, and make anybody whole. I'm not sure how anybody would have been affected by that. If you know, let me know. And then had to post, notices, to make sure that everybody knew that the chief violated the law by doing that. So, that's yeah, no confidence. Let me know what happened to the chief. Again, no confidence the chief. You normally don't do it unless what the outcome is going to be, and someone's waiting for that no confidence vote to ditch the chief. God for, I'm sure I just made that up. That's probably never happened. Here, I don't know what happened. So, and we're not going to Google who the fire chief of Compton is. So if you know who's if you're from Local 2216, you know what happened, let us know and I'll share it with the group. But that's pretty bread and butter. Good old retaliation, and even without it, that's a change to a mandatory subject of bargaining. All right, California. We're going to leave California. We're going to go back to Michigan. So two Michigans. Ooh, Michigan and Ohio. And I'm recording it on the day of the Buckeyes Wolverines game. That was not even intentional. It was subliminal. So this case is Luce County Sheriff and the Luce County Board of Commissioners, 39 MPER 11. It was decided a few months ago in 2025. This is a past practice case. Past practices are so confusing. And we get questions about these at our grievance seminars, and we always spend time and we always report out cases regarding past practices. And what's a past practice, right? Well, I always say, like, the past practice, like the contract, your collective bargaining agreement is like the skeleton, right? And past practices are all the other stuff, right? All the other things, the organs and the flesh and all the gross stuff. Because you can't write down everything, right? I mean, there are going to be things that happen, right? Things that are locked in, the way that we do things, that we can't write down every single rule. Employers, smart employers, sometimes will roll into negotiations and they'll say, hey, guys, we want to articulate all the past practices. So let's get a list together of the past practices. We'll slap them on the back of the contract. And that way, nobody's surprised when they say, hey, that's a past practice. And a lot of times unions will say, oh, that makes sense to me. I guess we should do that. Problem is, I promise you, you will never, ever remember all the past practices. That's the point. That's why they're a past practice. That's why they're not written down, right? I mean, that's just kind of how it works. And so, there are lots of disputes over like what a past practice is. And, that's a whole hour, discussion in and of itself. Basically, a past practice, it's not a one-off. It's something that has to be done in an open and a continuous way for an extended period of time. It's not secret. It literally is the way that we do things here. And if it goes one way sometimes and another way another times, that's not going to be enough to satisfy the standard to prove that something is an enforceable past practice. That's basically how an arbitrator or a labor board would look at this stuff. So what was going on in Luce County? This is an interesting one because this involves the dreaded inconsistent past practice, right? So that's where the contract says one thing, but the practice has been, I had an arbitrator kindly describe this as the contract was observed in the breach, right? So he got to say it was observed, but basically it was ignored. And so what happened in this particular case was in October of 2023, and this had to do with, a vacation cap, how much vacation you could carry over. It's a department where you could carry over unused vacation, but it was subject to a cap. And so there was some review at this particular county of the sheriff's office and payroll practices. They were having trouble with certain payroll issues. I don't know if they changed vendors or what it was, but they went and they looked at everybody's hours, and they found that in the timekeeping system, many, many, many deputy sheriffs in the department had more than 320 vacation hours. Well, so what? Who cares? Well, the issue was the contract, right? There was a contractual cap on vacation accrual that said that you could not accrue more than 320 hours of vacation. And so, what happened in the sheriff's department? Well, the sheriff's department observed that in the breach, apparently. So for many years, they just didn't enforce it. And I mean, many years. People just accrued, they went over it, they used it, didn't really matter. Until they have a new payroll clerk that does an audit and they say, uh-oh, we've exceeded the cap. What did the county do? Well, they did the most aggressive thing you could do. They just took everybody down to 320, right? So if you had 420, the county took 100 hours of vacation from you. They didn't cash people down, they just took it, right? And so lots of people lost time. The union demanded bargaining, the county refused, and the union filed an unfair practice saying that the county had changed a longstanding practice. They had unilaterally changed, made a change in an area that's a mandatory subject of bargaining, without bargaining with the union. They lost in this particular case. They lost the ALJ and they lost at the commission. It's because of the language in the contract. So here's what the commission said. The commission said that the collective bargaining agreement clearly limited vacation accrual to 320 hours. The contract actually said 40 days, so 40 days, 8 hour shifts, which is what they work. So it was they limited vacation accrual to 40 days. The language had been unchanged since 2010, right? So several contracts had gone by. The language had been in effect. It had been consistent. And the county did tolerate, excess vacation over the years. But there was no bargaining history regarding, proposals to change the practice. It was just that the county had, yeah, they had let people go over the limit. But according to the MERC, the Employment Relations Commission, a past practice cannot override clear contract terms unless both sides mutually intended to amend or waive the provision. And in this particular case, the MERC determined that the mere showing that the county had acquiesced in allowing people to exceed 320 hours was not sufficient to establish a binding modification to that clear contract language. What did the record show? The record showed the county had consistently retained a 320-hour cap in each contract. They'd never agreed to remove it. And there was never any discussion to remove it. It was just ignored. Based on those facts, Merck said that there was no obligation to bargain, or essentially the county had met its obligation to bargain, is a better way to say that, because they enforced the cap that was contained in the bargaining agreement. So that must reflect what the parties intended, a 320 hour limit or 40 day limit. Interesting case. That is the general rule. What I don't know, it wasn't in this particular decision. If this were an arbitration, I don't know how many people were affected, but it's not unusual to have arbitrators, or even a labor board maybe split it. Maybe an arbitrator, and I don't mean that as an insult to arbitrators, because people say, oh, they always split the difference. They don't always split the difference. But in an inconsistent past practice case, that's something that you do see, right? And so if the employer unilaterally just let people, accrue whatever they accrued, and then all of a sudden, after doing that for 15 years, they say we're going to enforce the contract. Actually, they don't say we're going to enforce the contract as written. They just take all the time that's in excess and say, oh yeah, we're enforcing the contract. That's ordinarily going to be a problem. And if you were to grieve that case and take that to arbitration, it would not surprise me at all if an arbitrator said that the employer could place the other party on notice of its intent to enforce this language that had been ignored at a date certain, but that act that it took in taking vacation time from people, that was improper, right? Because it was inconsistent with what was then the practice. And so my guess is if you took this case to arbitration, the people who lost their vacation time would have that returned to them, but the rule moving forward would be a 320-hour cap. That's normally how it goes. And that cuts both ways. A lot of times unions have provisions that they don't even realize, and if you want to enforce something that's been ignored, the best practice in my recommendation is to say, look, let the employer know we haven't, or employer, let the union know we haven't complied with this. We know it's been some period of time, but we're letting you know effective X date, we're going to enforce the contract as written. You got to provide some notice. And depending on, the length of time, some arbitrators will say you're stuck. An inconsistent past practice actually can trump clear language. This might have been a case where that could have happened, depending on how it was litigated. But I will say the general rule is that the contract language should govern. And so, be careful if you have an inconsistent past practice that's better than what the contract says, unions, just be aware that, that may not be the most solid ground if the employer decides they want to enforce that language in the future. So you could enjoy it, but maybe don't rely on it, I think is probably a good way to describe it. And that's going to bring us to the end of this month's First Thursday. Lots of cases. If you want the case citations, links, seminar registration info, all that stuff, it's all waiting for you at LRS.com. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on your platform of choice. Drop us a review. That does help others find the podcast and helps us justify putting in the work, on this every month. It does take some time to get this stuff together for you. Thanks again. I hope everybody had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. And, since it is the season of gratitude, please accept my thanks to you all for everything that you do out there to make your community safer and stronger. I hope everybody had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday season. I'll talk to you again after the new year in January. We're going to have more decisions, more analysis, and probably some predictions, of what we think we're going to see in 2026. Thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks for listening. See you next year.